Welcome to My Favorite Mystic, a podcast about the weird and wonderful world of mysticism. I'm AJ Langley, and today I'm joined by Delphi Nieto Isabel. She is Marie Curie, an Institute for Humanities and Social Sciences Fellow at Queen Mary University of London, and her work focuses on women, heresies, and social networks. Delphi, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, AJ. It's good to be here.
Well, it is an absolute pleasure to have you. So today you're here to speak to us about Na Pros Boneta.
Yes.
But before we talk about her, let's talk about you. How did you find yourself in the academic world of mysticism and heresy?
So that is a very convoluted story. I started out as a physicist. Actually, I was into astrophysics and astronomy, if you can believe it. And I was very interested about history because I've always thought that they have so much in common. Don't get me started on that because I can talk about it for hours. And I would define myself as a scholar of religious descent. But I first got into contact with mystics thanks to this module I enrolled in while I was doing my master's in medieval cultures, where I got to meet these wonderful women who wrote so much and said so much in these very strange narrative frameworks with this very rich imagery that I had never seen before. And it was fascinating to me. And then when I was deciding on a topic for my master's dissertation, I stumbled upon this woman, Na Pros Boneta. So it's actually very relevant that I'm going to talk about her today because she was my doorway into this fabulous world of medieval mysticism. And I have to say it is a very weird doorway, as I think will become apparent as we talk more about it.
Well, if that's not a teaser, I don't know what is. I'm very excited to hear about the incredibly weird door that is Na Pros. But just before we do, I'm interested in, was mysticism what led you to the work you now do on religious descent?
Yes. Through mysticism, I ended up doing what is commonly referred to as heresy, which I like to talk in terms of religious descent, because I think it's a more accurate expression to actually tell us what these dynamics of religious change in the Middle Ages were about. So that's the story.
So reflecting on this very convoluted journey of yours, firstly, I'm so glad that we stole you from the sciences. That makes me very happy. But also, I do want to ask a little bit about why you think physics and history are so similar, because they seem diametrically opposite to me.
So basically, physics is about understanding how nature works. And I think that history is very much about understanding how human beings work or have worked in the past, which I think is very necessary to understand how they work nowadays. So in the end, it's looking at a very complex system with lots of variables and trying to, I wouldn't say predict, because this is a controversial word, but to know what lies beneath it in a way. So obviously, and I have to say this, physics ends up being way simpler than history because you can actually predict what particles will do on any given day. And it's way harder to say what humans will do on any given day, as anybody who's reading the news nowadays can tell you.
I love that we as historians deal with the unpredictable. That's such a fun way of thinking about it.
Absolutely. Especially because we are dealing with things that happened in the past. And not even knowing how the story went, are we able to say why things happened perfectly. I don't think historians ever get a complete picture of anything. We're just doing our best with the sources we have. So that's also very interesting to me, how we can actually build a believable picture of the past based on fragments of things that are left behind. And that's very poetic in a way.
Absolutely. The idea that we construct stories about the past based on fragments, and that those who don't study history are all about how we know all of these facts.
Oh, yes.
It is one of my favorite things to disillusion my history undergrads about is, no, we don't deal in facts. We deal in perhapses.
Yes. Can I say something very controversial?
Yes, absolutely. The answer to that question is always going to be yes.
Actually, science is belifting as if it was dogma. And that's because people don't know how science is made. And science ends up being about facts, but that's why it's very important to study history of science to understand that it's not so far away from history, especially because all the greatest scientists that people know by name also had a context that produced them in a way. And that's why I find so many connections between the two.
Well, in my humble opinion, that was not controversial at all, but then again, I am a history person rather than a science person, so the objections may come from other quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So now let's move on to the woman of the hour. Her name is Na Pros Boneta, which is an interesting name because Na is not a name, it's actually a title?
That's right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So for starters, I should say that some may have heard her name as Prus, because that's the French pronunciation. But since she never spoke French, because we haven't mentioned this yet, but she lived in southern France, present-day southern France, but in the period it was Languedoc. And she probably spoke something like Languedocian Occitan, which has a lot more in common with present-day Catalan than with present-day French. So I'm using the pronunciation that I find was probably closest to her actual way of saying her name. So that's why they say Pros. But the thing is that, as you said, Pros is her first name, but we always talk about her using this Na particle before her name. And that's very interesting in itself, because Na is a particle that's still surviving in present-day Catalan, and it's used to refer to a woman in a very respectful way. But in the medieval past, this particle was reserved for women who were very respected in a charismatic sort of way, especially because this woman lived in the 14th century. And in the early 14th century, this particle was only used to refer to that kind of respect. So you wouldn't get a Na in front of your name because you were wealthy, or because you had a very good social standing. You would get that particle because you were respected because of your charismatic presence. And in a very religious sense, if I may say so, because you actually find other women in the same period, both in Languedoc and also to the south in Catalonia, whose names are used with the Na particle in front of them. And they are always women that are known for their charity because they lead pious lives. I wouldn't go as far as to say saintly, but to a point, they had a very good reputation as good Christians, someone to be respected in a way, I would say. So that Na in front of her name is a world in itself, because as we have the chance to talk more about her, you will see that she ended up as exactly the opposite. But still, that particle in front of her name reminds us of her actual context and how she was a figure of authority among her neighbors and the people who knew her.
That is a lot of meaning to pack into a very short title.
Yes, two letters. Yeah. It's like DR, right? So in a way...
No, absolutely. Fair point. So let's talk about her then. What do we know about her and how she achieved this important status and then potentially lost it? What kind of sources do we have to talk about her life?
Okay, so I should start by saying that unlike many of the women you've discussed and also men in your podcast, the things we know about Na Pros come just from the handful of documents, all of them recorded at the behest of inquisitors. So basically, what we know about her comes from her persecution. That's the first thing I'd like to say. So she was probably born around 1296, 1297. She was born in a very small village, like 50 kilometers north from Montpellier, which was a great hub, commercial, social, economic, political hub in the period. And she and her family moved to Montpellier when she was a little girl. She was probably around 7 years old, and they all moved to Montpellier. This was not unusual in the region. Many people migrated to areas where the economy was better and the opportunities for a business or a job even were better. But what's interesting is that she and her family probably had religious motives, or at least part of their motivation was religious in nature. This is not something I've come up with myself. Louisa Burnham has discussed this. She has a great article entitled The Visionary Authority of Na Pros Boneta, which I recommend to listeners. And the thing is that she was from this small village. I haven't said the name. It's Saint-Michel de la Cadière, really like 35 households in all. And next to or near enough to that village, there was another village a bit bigger. It's called Ganges, still standing today. And there was a Franciscan convent there. And this is the first time that Franciscans appear in this story. And this was not unusual either, because honestly, in that region and in that period, you could find Franciscans hiding under every rock. There were so many Franciscan convents in the area, it was like prevalent. And probably the family got in contact with this sort of Franciscan sphere of spirituality there, and then moved to Montpellier, where the Franciscan scene was very active. The thing is that these were not like your run-of-the-mill Franciscans in Montpellier. I mean, these were spiritual Franciscans, which were a brand unto themselves. In the last quarter of the 13th century, we have a lot of issues within the Order of St. Francis. And we see like the formation of two groups. The spiritual Franciscans were the radical ones. So they kept advocating for a very strict interpretation of the rule of St. Francis, which meant, yes, you've taken a vow of poverty. That means that you cannot own anything. But let's go one step further. That also means that you cannot use anything that you don't actually need. Which is, if you think about that and you think in terms of our daily lives and you had to stop using everything that you don't actually need. I mean, it's a pretty strong argument. And even in the day, it was a very strong argument for other Franciscans who said, well, as long as I don't own anything, that's okay. So this notion had come from a very controversial theologian, Peter of John Olivia, and I'm mentioning him because he will be paramount for the whole development of necrosis experience. And many lay people followed this way of seeing things. And they supported spiritual Franciscans, even against very hostile intervention of the other side of the Franciscan order, and finally, the intervention of the Pope. Because things were so bad and became so bad that the Pope had to intervene to try and, you know, make peace, which he didn't succeed in doing, let me tell you. So long story short, 1318, four Franciscan friars are burned at the stake in Marseille. And soon after, their lay followers start being burned in the streets. And where is Nepros in the midst of all this? So Nepros will be one among many who were captured and brought in front of the inquisitors to declare as to their support of Franciscan views and as to their involvement in this whole heresy of the burned begins, as it ended up being called. So do you want a spoiler? She will die at the stake, probably 1328. Because of her beliefs, which are actually what make her ideal, I think, for this podcast, but you will be the judge of that.
Okay, so this is the kind of climate that she's coming up in, and we only have inquisitorial records, which means they're potentially trying to paint her in a very particular light in their records. So where does that leave us when trying to discuss Nepros?
Well, I would say that the first thing we have to say, it's legitimate to ask ourselves, well, can we trust this source? Because honestly, it's written by a very hostile system made up of inquisitorial scribes, notaries, inquisitors themselves. So why should we trust what we have on written record? Well, for starters, in all of these depositions in front of the inquisitors, we always find expressions such as gratis et desponte, which means freely and voluntarily. Then again, you can ask yourself, well, how free do you feel in front of the inquisitor? How voluntarily are you declaring when you are arrested? But one thing that Nepros's deposition adds that no other deposition has is that it includes two little words that mean a world, because they say sine interrogatione, which means without interrogation. So whereas the rest of the people who were arrested for this crime were thoroughly interrogated using a question list that inquisitors had devised after trying to understand what this heresy was about, Nepros said, okay, you want me to confess? I will confess. And hers is actually the longest deposition in the records. We are talking about 28 folios of deposition, which is quite a lot. And she starts explaining her whole life and her whole visionary and mystical experience, which started when she was 9 years old. And let me just give you the cliff notes of that story. When she's 9 years old, she decides to take a vow of virginity. And then soon after, she goes to visit the tomb of Peter of John Libby. That's why I said it. He's central to her whole thing, her whole experience. And when she is visiting the tomb, a nine-year-old girl, she has her first mystical experience. She feels an odor of sanctity. She feels warmth as if something was wrapped around her shoulders. She feels elevated while visiting the tomb. So we could argue that this actually tells us more about Peter of John Olivia. He's a saint. than about herself. But the thing is that she's the only one, even though many other members of the group talk about how Olivier should be a saint and describe him as an uncanonized saint, she actually has the full experience, the full mystical experience. She's the only one. And then we have to wait 15 years until she has her second, and this time, full-on visionary experience. She's at the church. It's Good Friday. And after the service is done, she's going home. And suddenly Christ appears in front of her in the middle of the church. She's the only one left in the church, I have to say. And then she has a very interesting vision where Christ opens up his side and shows her through, you know, the wound on his side, a small lantern. Christ opens the lantern, and inside the lantern is Christ's heart. And suddenly she's admitted into Christ's heart. And she's illuminated. She experiences the delights of heaven after being inside Christ's heart. And then she goes home and she's questioning herself, thinking, well, should I talk about this? And she doesn't until she's told. And this is very, as you know, very usual with many other mystics. It's like, I didn't want to talk about this, but God told me you have to talk about this. And then she shares her experience. And then she will start on a journey with several visions, and even more interesting than the visions, which are pretty interesting themselves, revelations that come to her through words. So she listens to words being spoken to her that give her a very powerful set of messages. And also, after a while, she feels the presence of God that stays with her full time. So that's sort of the story. I should say that she doesn't live alone. She lives with her sister, Aliceta, another companion called Alaraxis the dog, and probably, although this is more difficult to prove using the record, another sister called Stevana. So we have three or four women living together. Their father is long gone. And this is a model that reminds us very much of these communities of beings living together and talking about God. Actually, the moment they choose to talk about God is after dinner. We see this in the record. And that's basically the gist of it. But let's say that the first full-on vision is this one with the heart inside the lantern through the wound on Christ's side, which again recalls many other experiences, mystical experiences that were happening in this period in other places of Europe.
Okay, so I definitely want to hear more about these visions. Let's get to that in just a second. But for those who are maybe not as familiar with Peter John Olivi, he is normally associated with apocalyptic theology. So is that a connection that we see coming through in Napros as well? Was she also very concerned about the end of days?
Yes, actually, there's two common threads throughout her visions. One of them is very much apocalyptic. She talks about the Antichrist and how the Antichrist is upon us. And the other one is the Holy Spirit. And these two threads are very much connected, because actually one of the things that was central to these spiritual Franciscans was poverty. But the other one was the fact that we were reaching the end of the second age, and the third age was coming in full force. And that's the age of the Spirit. And the thing about the age of the Spirit is that everybody will gain this sort of understanding through love, the intellectus amoris in Latin, which is very dangerous, because of course, if you understand things through the heart, through emotions, through love, it's dangerously close to saying that you don't need any kind of mediation. And you know that that's always a problem in this context and with this mystics, right? So for Napros, I will put it out there right now, and then we can talk more about it. But it's not just about the Antichrist and the age of the Spirit. She is the incarnation of the Holy Spirit. This is her big claim in her deposition. And suddenly your mouth is open, because it's like, what? But yes, that's what she claims to be, the incarnation of the Holy Spirit. And needless to say, inquisitors will not be happy about this.
No. And those of you who are not lucky enough to be part of the video portion of this call taking place at the moment will have missed when my mouth did dramatically fall open as Delphi said that. What on earth do you mean that she thought that she was the reincarnation of the Holy Spirit? What is she, what?
Well, so among other things, and one of the most interesting things that she says, and she makes perfect sense. And I want to be really clear about this, because something that she has against her in terms of making it as a figure of medieval mysticism is that she never wrote anything. So we don't have a piece of writing that's authored by her or dictated by her, or in a hagiographer kind of sense. So what we have is basically the record, and not a complete record either, because that's not how inquisitorial records work, of something she was talking about. And as this interview or this conversation we're having makes abundantly clear, speech is not always well structured. I mean, you keep rambling on, and that's what she did. And that's the problem, because the record of that rambling on is sometimes very convoluted, not always clear. There's not a specific structure to it. She keeps talking and talking and talking, and she goes back to some topics and rephrases. And so it doesn't have a structure, in a word. And that made scholars in the past talk about her in very dismissive terms, saying that she was a psychotic, that she was a crazy woman, that she didn't know. She was obviously hysterical, because that's what you say about women who have this kind of experiences, right? And so she was very much abused by scholarship until the 1980s, if you can believe that. So that's for starters. But if you let me put a bit of structure in what she's saying, actually, she has a flawless logic, because she says, okay, so we have the paradise, Adam, Eve, we all know what happened there. Things didn't go well. And humanity lost grace because humanity was expelled from paradise. Okay, what did we need for grace to come back to us? We needed the Holy Trinity getting involved in the thing. So the second person of the Holy Trinity, that is the Son, had to incarnate in the body of a virgin and then die. And therefore, grace was restored to humanity because of his sacrifice. Okay, so far so good. Then things happen in the church. The church is led astray. And we have this terrible Pope, John the 22nd, and I'm sort of paraphrasing that prose. And he committed all sorts of crimes and killed the righteous and condemned the writings of Pier of John Levy, who, of course, was the righteous among the righteous, and many other misdeeds that she describes in detail, according to her, obviously. And what's happened as a result of the misdeeds of this Pope, humanity has lost grace again. So the Holy Trinity needs to intervene again. But this time around, what will the Holy Trinity do? So the third person needs to incarnate itself into the body of a virgin and therefore bring about a return grace to humanity. And who is the virgin? The virgin is Nepros. And at some point she says, well, obviously since the second person ended up being a man, things were not so great. So it makes sense this time around it will be a woman. But there's a problem with this, because obviously Christ, he incarnates in the virgin, but actually ends up being a full person. But what happens with the Holy Spirit? Well, the Holy Spirit is a spirit by definition. So it won't come out from the virgin as a fully formed human being, but it will be incarnated in the spirit of the virgin and in the words of the virgin. Actually, she uses a beautiful expression, her body of words, which I think is very poetic again. And that's the full story. So the Holy Spirit in the body of Nepros needs to go through all the things that Christ went through. So ridicule, torment in many different ways, and finally die in a condemned, in a most ignominious way, so that grace will be restored to humanity. So you see, it's a flawless logic in a way. But of course, you need to read through it attentively to say, well, she's not crazy. She's making perfect sense. I mean, in her whole framework, right?
And I mean, that makes total sense with what you said earlier about how she's confessing without needing to be tortured or threatened in any way, because next step on this progression she's got for herself is condemnation and death. So I suppose let's just get it rolling.
Absolutely. She even says, you know, that it's very common among mystics to say, well, I respond to a higher authority, which is well and good, but it takes some guts to say that in front of inquisitors. And she actually says explicitly, even if you burn me, I will be a saint in paradise, because I respond to a higher authority. I mean, God is telling me to say this, and my truth comes from God. So honestly, whatever you say, I don't really care. I mean, obviously, I'm very much paraphrasing her, but that's the thing you get from the whole deposition. And I always picture open-mouthed inquisitors like, what are you saying? What is this?
There's a really interesting comparison here between Nepros and another mystic that we talked about recently, Marguerite Porrette, who was also accused of heresy. And there's a really funny juxtaposition here between Marguerite Porrette being silent and just, I'm not going to answer any of your questions, versus Nepros is just, let me tell you everything, I'll tell you everything I think.
Absolutely. It's so interesting to put them together because they actually accomplished the same using two very opposite means. I mean, they are getting their say in one way or another and empowering themselves and their message through silence or through speech. And it's very interesting to see how that happens in these two cases, obviously, because they shared a context. They were alive at the same time. I mean, Marguerite is executed 1310 and the Prose will die 18 years later. So.
And when you say they got their messages across, let's get back to what Napros's message was. Because so far we have she's the reincarnation of the Holy Spirit and Pope John XXII is awful. But other than those two key points, what is she trying to say as far as we have it recorded in these depositions?
Well, she was convinced that the whole apocalyptic system was about to happen. And her confession is full of apocalyptic imagery. This has a lot to do with the fact that among her community, the last of Olivi's written works was also very much read aloud and shared and discussed. It's the commentary on the apocalypse, the Lectura Super Apocalypsum, which he finished 1 year before his death in 1298. And this text was sort of, I mean, it wasn't officially condemned until 1326, but right from the beginning, it was censured and the copies were gathered to be burned. But this just happened like a year after Olivi's death. And still, it was already too late because the Latin version had already been translated and was in circulation among those groups. So it's clear that Napros has had access to that text. And the interesting thing is that she's reinterpreting the words of Olivi. And I'm drawing your attention to this because she's presented as an illiterate woman. And she's been repeatedly portrayed as an illiterate woman in the sense that she had no Latin. And that is obvious. And she even, when she describes her whole way of praying, she says that basically she recites Pater Nosters, our fathers, because that's the way that lay people were supposed to pray, especially within Franciscan environments, let's say, when they had no Latin. So she was illiterate in the sense that she had no Latin, that's clear. But honestly, I'm not so convinced that she was not perfectly literate in her own mother tongue. And it's something that I've never been able to prove, and I doubt I will be able to prove, but I'm very much convinced that she was literate in her own mother tongue. So she does not simply repeat what Olivi is saying. She's reframing the whole thing to include herself in the history of salvation, which is very much amazing. And then, of course, she goes into discussing what does it mean that the age of the Holy Spirit is here. So obviously, sacraments really don't bother going to the sacrament of the altar because Eucharist is void and null. Obviously, grace has been lost. So what's the point? Also, don't do penance because that doesn't matter anymore. The only thing you need to do to be saved, the only, you know, quotation marks there, is to believe in the Holy Spirit, which, by the way, is me. So as long as you believe in my words, which are the words of the Holy Spirit, you're good to go. That's her whole point. As you see, it's more and more controversial and very difficult to swallow for inquisitors. Also, she's very committed to the whole political scene of the moment, because in 1321, there was this massive killing of lepers happening in southern France. And this happened because, you know, there was this conspiracy theory at some point that, you know, they were trying to poison the wells of Christianity, obviously, after an agreement with Jews and Muslims to put some potion in the wells so that everybody would become a leper. That's the conspiracy theory of the period. One of the men in charge of the leper house of Toulouse, Guillermo Agast, was arrested and he was tortured. Torture was not frequent among medieval inquisitors, but we know that Guillermo Agast was actually tortured. James Gibbon has discussed this. And immediately people went absolutely crazy and started dragging people out of leper houses and killing them on the spot. And these means men, women, and children alike. Nobody spoke in their favor. Philip the Fair, who had legal jurisdiction over the area, the King of France, actually didn't care. And the Pope himself said, I don't have anything to do with this. You know, it's not my jurisdiction. And actually, Napros speaks in favor of the lepers. She talks about them as innocents who were killed and compares their massacre to the massacre of the innocent. And therefore, since Herod authorized the massacre of the innocent, then John XXII is obviously like Herod and Caiaphas, and every single bad guy in the gospel is exactly like John the 22nd. And as for other very interesting things that she says in her deposition, and actually make a lot of sense when you think about it from a logical perspective, I'm going to tell you this story and I hope you enjoy it, because maybe I'm going to be off topic. But she explains the story of Lucifer. So Lucifer started out as an angel. We all know that. And according to Nepros, he had the most beautiful name among angels, which was Lucibel, which actually was basically that, the most beautiful of angels. But then we all know what happened. He committed a sin of pride against the Lord and therefore was cast out of heaven. And suddenly his name was not Lucibel anymore, but Lucifer, which according to Nepros is the worst name an angel could ever have. So here comes the Pope. For starters, he was elected as the Pope and therefore as the representative of God on earth. And he was given the most beautiful name among men, that is Pope. But now, because of all he has done, all his misdeeds and persecuting the righteous and killing the innocent and whatnot, he suddenly has the worst name that a man can have, Antichrist. So again, the logic is flawless, but obviously the result is that the Pope is the Antichrist, which again, would not fly with Inquisitors.
No, I suppose it wouldn't.
I have to say, she was not the only one saying that the Pope was the Antichrist, but she said it in this very beautiful argumentative way.
Can we talk for a second about the timeline here? Because I'm slightly lost. So Peter John Alevi dies in 1298. His works are condemned in 1299. Pope John XXII doesn't get elected until 1316. So how much of this is really his fault and how much should be blamed on the previous pope? Or do we have a whole bunch of other charges to lay at his feet for the stuff that he did himself?
Yeah, the thing is that actually Olivi's words are not declared officially heretical by the Pope in 1299. They are just censored at a more provincial level, if you will. The whole process of condemnation of Olivi's work is not done until 1326, so the Pope is fully present there. But there's also something else. Throughout the first decade and a half of the 14th century, things are not particularly auspicious for spiritual Franciscans and for their lay supporters and followers, but at least they are not officially persecuted. So with Clement V, everything seems to be, you know, coming to a standstill in the sense of, let's not hurt ourselves with this. Everybody, you know, keep to your corners and we will be fine. But we all know that Clement V doesn't end that well. And when John the 22nd arrives, he immediately makes a decision in favor of law, I would say. He makes a decision saying, well, you're incumbent, so you should obey your superiors, even if those superiors are telling you to do something that is not what you think the rule of St. Francis is telling you to do. And that's where things start to basically go very badly, very fast for spiritual Franciscans. So that's 1316, as you said, when John the 22nd comes into power. But then 1317, he issues a bull, it's called Sancta Romana, in which he actually starts allowing bishops to persecute these groups of men and women who are not official members of any sanctioned rule and still are supporting the views of Franciscans, but they are not an actual order and therefore they are outside the law. And then 1318, he basically makes the whole inquisitorial process against these four Franciscan friars who die at the stake. He makes it happen. And so for her, it's very clear that things were not so bad until this Pope came along. And this is when things started to go downhill very quickly. That's why that's the turning point in a way for her. And also for the whole movement, I have to say, the communities of Begins of Languedoc, also founded at 1318, have been a turning point for them.
Okay. So this coming of the age of the Holy Spirit and her being the incarnation of the Holy Spirit, how does that come about? When does she find out that this is who she is? Is there some sort of revelation that she has? Do we have a description of that exact moment and how she knows she's the Holy Spirit?
Well, for her, it's clear because Christ tells her so. He gives her a date. Christ says, when you made your vow of virginity and then went to visit the tomb of Olivi, that's when you received the Spirit. Of course, she was 9 years old. And afterwards, she doesn't have this enlightening experience in which Christ starts to talk to her and explain how things went until 1321. But again, this is not uncommon for mystics. They have one, the first experience, and then years afterwards, they start to understand that experience. So that's what happens to her. That's why it's so interesting, because there's so many common things that we can see in her case and also in other cases of mystics in the same period afterwards and before her period. So she's clearly a part of that mystical tradition. That's one of the reasons why it's very difficult for me to think that she was illiterate and she had no contact with these other traditions that were going on. Because, for example, one of the visions she has is the typical log that is being burned. And then Christ says, see, so the fire transforms timber into something else. That's how my grace will transform you into something else. And that is a very Cistercian thing to say. It's a very old theme, a mystical thought. So how is she exposed to that? Obviously, she has sources of information that have not been preserved, but it's clear because of the things she says that she has a mystical culture. Can I say that? Because obviously that's sort of thing that you can read through the lines of her deposition. It's very clear. There are so many things in common with other mystical experiences.
And do the records say anything about how she communicated this message, if she tried to spread it, if she had a large gathering of followers? Do we know what kind of impact she had?
Actually, we know that she kept spreading her message to many people within the community. And a very interesting thing is that she presents it. And that's the only part that I slightly mistrust about her deposition, but I think it was on purpose. But again, I'm letting my imagination fly away. But the thing is that she sort of explains to the inquisitors how her message is not coming across. I mean, nobody's listening to her, and she tries to explain her message to people, but they don't believe her, and she's ridiculed. Again, one of the instances in which she is allegedly ridiculed, she goes on to compare it to, you know, Christ talking to the doctors of the law and the doctors of the law mocking Christ. So she says, well, I had to go through the same thing, because obviously. But then again, we know, thanks to other depositions, that actually people listen to her. Starting with her sister, who refused for a whole year being imprisoned to admit that what her sister Prose was experiencing was not a message from God. She had to spend a full year in an inquisitorial prison until she admitted that, well, maybe it's not from God. But actually, when she was arrested and taken to the prison in Carcassonne, we know that other people were convinced by her message inside the prison. So we know that she kept going on about it. And I've always thought that what she's actually trying to do in front of the inquisitors, she's not playing down her own commitment to keep spreading the news, because she knows where she's going. And actually, she wants to go there, I think. But she's actually trying to play down the involvement of others. So she's okay with passing herself off as a voice preaching in the desert. Nobody listened, because it sort of plays into her whole role as, you know, going through this torment, the cross, in a way that I don't need to implicate others to prove that. You know what I mean? But we know that she kept doing that. And also because of another piece of evidence that it's really separated from the rest, we know that she actually had a part in a sort of network of people who were trying to help others flee the region. We have a single mention of her in a document in which a house is discussed, in which we met there to decide which was the best route for people to flee the area and into Mallorca and into Naples, which is sort of what I'm studying right now. But we know she was there. So that means that she was very much involved with the community, but sadly, we only have a part of the record. And then again, we have this very interesting piece of evidence. The Pope writes to the Inquisitor saying, you know what, you'd better not burn her in Montpellier. Take her to Carcassonne and burn her there. Well, obviously, he's not saying burn them, because you know how they were very polite about this. But, you know, you should pass sentence in Carcassonne and not in Montpellier. And he doesn't say anything else. He says, for a variety of reasons. That's as clear as he goes. But you keep thinking, why? It's the only single mention we have of the Pope directly intervening in these trials. The only one. And these trials brought before the inquisitors over 200 people. And the only time in which the Pope actually says, do this, refers to Prose. And also a very important piece of evidence. She's the only person among the 218 people whose records have survived, who is called a heresiarch, a master of heretics, the only one in the whole movement. men and women alike. And honestly, this doesn't speak about somebody who doesn't know what she's saying, or someone who doesn't have a following or has no impact whatsoever on others.
No, absolutely. And I mean, even from the very beginning, we were talking about this title of Na being given to charismatic, influential people as an honorific. I mean, that in itself speaks to the fact that she must have had some sort of following and that people must have believed her to some extent.
Yes. Also, one thing I always tell my students when I talk about her is, for us, it may be very far-fetched to say, hey, I'm the incarnation of the Holy Spirit. Nobody's going to believe you. But we have to remember that we are in the early 14th century. People were expecting something. Something was happening, was about to happen. The age of the Holy Spirit was about to happen. And let us remember that a couple decades before this, I mean, late 14th century, we have the example of Guglielma of Bohemia happening in Milan, who was also believed to be the incarnation of the Holy Spirit by her followers. So it was not so weird to think that the Holy Spirit was coming. And more importantly, it was not so weird to believe that he would incarnate in the body of a woman. Because again, that's the good thing about the Spirit, right? Christ is a man and therefore the Son, right? This is very gender vocabulary. The Son needs a male body, but the Spirit doesn't. That's why female participation is so prevalent, or at least so important among these groups whose spirituality is revolving around the Spirit.
That is fantastic. Let's go back and talk about these visions. Is there one that is your particular favorite?
I love one particular vision. It's one of the shortest, but it's so almost funny in a way. So the Spirit is with her, obviously, and she suddenly sees two men, which the Latin says similar to God. That's how they are described. And then they come running at her and jump on her. And one of these men jumps on her neck, and the other of this, we assume that these are small men, obviously, and the other one jumps and ends up perched on her arm. And then Christ says, well, you have the Spirit, now you have the Holy Trinity. The three of us are with you. And I think this is a spectacular way of describing the Holy Trinity running at you and jumping on you, and now you have all of us, right? And I mean, it's probably not the most significant vision among the visions she has, but it's one that has always seemed special to me in that sense. She's trying to explain the Holy Trinity, and she does a very good job of it. Also, of course, she has all sorts of metaphorical visions. And the good thing is that she explains the vision as it came to her, which is sometimes very bizarre. And immediately afterwards, she explains what Christ told her to explain the vision. So it's not like she needs to figure it out for herself. She has the vision. And immediately afterwards, Christ comes along and says, well, what you have seen means this and this and that. So, for example, the extension of, I mean, how grace was lost to humanity and how there is a sort of gateway and she's the gateway. And once the gateway is open and somebody believes in the gateway, then grace, this is a sort of causeway in a river and all the water has dried out from one side of the river and it's in the other side. And once the gateway is open and that's Napros, then the grace will flow back into humanity. So very basically, she just explains the image and immediately, and Christ told me that this meant that this was this and this was that. So we don't even have to make the effort to think, what did she mean? I mean, she knows what she meant because Christ told her so.
I really like it when it is that straightforward. Here is this vision. I saw a whole bunch of really random things, but here is the explanation. So you don't have to think about it or worry what it might potentially mean. It makes the vision so much easier to understand, not only, I assume, as a modern reader, but it must have been so much easier for her contemporaries to know what she was talking about as well.
You know what I think? I think that she's very used to explain these to other people. This is not the first time she's doing it. It's just the first time that she's doing it in front of a very hostile audience, the Inquisitors. But she's very didactic in her explanations. So it seems like probably she explained her visions to others and then immediately explain what the visions meant. And again, she keeps going back to this theme of, I wouldn't have talked about this for the life of me. And she goes to very extreme examples, like even if a sword had fallen on me or a lightning had fallen on me, I would rather have that than explaining these things and talking about myself in these terms. But Christ told me, you need to do it. And that's why I'm doing it. So it's, in a way, she's legitimizing her message in two different ways. First, it comes from God. So that's good in itself, right? But then again, God is telling me to spread the news. So what can I do, right? I can just go along with it.
I mean, she sounds so fantastic, and it makes me kind of sad that we don't have more about her, or we don't have anything that she wrote herself. But there is this really cool aspect to the idea that she just walked into this room and said, okay, let me tell you why you're going to think I'm a heretic. I will tell you all about it.
Yes, I mean, once she decides to talk, she doesn't care anymore. And she goes full on visionary authority on them. And honestly, for me, it's very understandable how she would have had this charisma that would have attracted people to believe in what she was saying. Because honestly, if you can talk in those terms in front of the Inquisitors, in front of normal people who are your friends or family members, you must be a force to be reckoned with. And how could they not take her seriously? Especially because, as I said, in this context, they were kind of expecting the Holy Spirit and the Apocalypse and the Antichrist. As I always say, actually, the persecution in this case was a huge factor for them to believe that they were right all along, because they were expecting for the righteous to be persecuted. That's what's supposed to happen when the Antichrist comes along. And that's exactly what happened. They were persecuted. And people who they saw as righteous people who led good lives, they were pious, they were chaste, they were humble. Suddenly, they were burning at the stake. And therefore, that's exactly what was supposed to happen when the Antichrist came along. And since the Antichrist was supposed to be someone who appeared to be very pious, but actually was the root of all evil, it made a lot of sense for them to think, oh, wait a minute, who's persecuting us? This guy who is the Pope. Therefore, he's supposed to be the best of all of us, but instead he's doing this. So therefore, who's the Antichrist? Obviously, it must be him. And for her, it was so clear. And he keeps repeating this motive once and again and giving different reasons why she's so sure that it's John the 22nd. That's because of his own stupidity, actually, at some point, she even says he has become the persecutor of the righteous and therefore the Antichrist.
This is yet another example of how important historical context is to understanding these figures and how they operated in the world. Because people did truly believe in this period that the end of days was coming. The apocalypse was around every corner. So the idea that somebody would show up and say, oh no, it definitely is. You are 100% right. I am going to make sure that you are all okay when that does happen. It makes perfect sense in that particular period and that worldview.
Yes. And actually, for the members of our community, because another thing is that Livy, in his commentary on the Apocalypse, had basically left it open that the Antichrist was almost upon us, but he didn't mention any specific time frame. He just said, we are close to this. This is going to happen. It's now, and it's not in a century. It's almost upon us. And they picked up on that. And you have, among the depositions of these people, you have very different theories as to when it's happening. Some of them say, well, the Antichrist right now, I don't know who he is, but he's about 20 years old because he was incarnated at this moment. And for others, it's clear it is the Pope. And this is the clue that I'm giving you that this Pope is the Antichrist. And we have several different versions. But for them all, it was very clear that the apocalypse was upon us. And with the apocalypse, and that's the good thing, the age of the Holy Spirit, because we don't have to picture them as being a scared crowd, like, oh my God, the apocalypse is upon us, we are all going to die. No, it was fear, but it was also a lot of hope. And many other scholars have discussed about how the apocalypse brings about these two emotions, right? But for them, it was clear that it was hope because they were among the righteous. So whatever happened, I mean, everybody, there was a huge period of tribulations upon us, but don't worry, because either you will end up as a martyr in paradise directly without having to wait, or you would be safe in the end because you're among the righteous. And it's them that are doing the persecuting, and it's the Pope that's the heretic, which is also very interesting for the history of heresy itself, right? How heresy is in the eye of the beholder, as many have said before me.
Absolutely. And so you could really see why Napros's message of, I am the incarnation of the Holy Spirit, the end of days is upon us, all you have to do is believe in me and you'll be among the righteous. Like, that's an easy thing to do if you can just make that leap of faith to believe in her. And as you have told us, you know, people did leap to this message. And you talked about briefly, she was even continuing to spread this message while she was under arrest, after she had been caught and during this interrogation process.
to the point that we have examples of people saying, you know what, I was going to recant and think that, yes, I was wrong and my beliefs were wrong and the church is right. But then I talked to her and, you know what, now I've changed my mind. I'm okay. I'm going to stuck with my beliefs, which again, let us remember, we are talking to the inquisitors. This is not your confessor. This is a body of power that can send you to death in the most horrible way.
Incredible. Okay, we are coming towards the end of the podcast now, so we just have the one final question, which is, Delphi, why is Napros your favorite mystic?
Well, she was the first, and that's always special, but I think that one thing that has always amazed me about her is how consistent she was and how brave in the face of adversity. This was the first time she was captured, which meant that even after saying all these things that she said, she could have recanted at any time. And given the inquisitorial pattern, even with such severe or very out there statements, she would have been sent to prison. And after a few years, she would have been released. Her sentence would have been commuted by something else. So her life would have been spared. But still, she kept saying, what I'm saying is the truth because God told me, and I don't care what you say because I know that I am in possession of the truth and I'm willing to die for this. And I'm fascinated by this, not just because of the courage that you need to do that, but also because from a position of no power at all, she empowered herself. Because if you think about it, she didn't leave anything for her persecutors. She took away from them the decision. After that, they could not decide on forgiving her or sending her to prison. She was actually dictating her own sentence. And there's so much power and so much strength on that. And that's what I admire the most about her. I mean, how can you not?
And I mean, even though, as you mentioned, they say, oh, you know, nobody listened to me. I was shouting in the desert, in the actual records. The "na" at the front of her name, the fact that, as you stated, the fact that, as you said, this is the only case that the Pope directly intervened in and said, you're going to want to try this somewhere else, assuming potential retaliation, shows the impact that she really must have had.
And you know what? The cherry on top of all this is that her whole story would have been lost to history because the archives of the period were destroyed and scattered. And what we have is a copy, a 17th century copy, made by chance among many other copies of the documents that were in the inquisitorial archives that ended up in Paris. And that's the only piece of evidence that has left a trace behind her. And this incredible woman was brave enough to do all that and to say to the inquisitors, I don't care about what you do to me because I know I'm right. And we wouldn't have heard about her if it wasn't for the things that happened by chance in history. And I'm so grateful that I got to read it and to find this piece of herself. And it has inspired my whole research about finding the hidden voices of women that have been lost to history.
Well, then myself and all of your other colleagues have great reason to thank Napros for inspiring you and all of the incredible work you do. Delphi, thank you so much for joining me today and telling me all about Napros Bonetta.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk about her and a pleasure to talk to you.
And thank you all for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at MyFaveMystic and join me next time when I speak to Harry Hudspeth about Teresa of Avila.